Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob Enyart Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Last week, we had an interview with Vice President of LifeSite News, Gualberto Garcia Jones, and he told us about an event coming up there, which has now happened, and it was an all-day extravaganza. One of the speakers was our own attorney for Denver Bible Church, Rebecca Messel, and what an honor to have Rebecca on now with us. Rebecca, thanks for making this time.
Well, good morning, Bob, and thank you. It's a privilege to be representing yourself and Denver Bible Church.
Well, that's so kind of you and Brad Burkford. You guys are quite a team. But I know we're not going to talk about our case, but what I'd like to ask you about is actually a few things. You talk about this connection between a couple U.S. Supreme Court cases, one being the infamous Buck versus Bell. So I'd like to talk about that. But also, I don't know if an article you wrote 10 years ago has gotten the attention it deserves, but it's titled Standing Bear is a Person, a stunning account in the history of America, a devastating account, actually. I'm hoping we can talk about that. Buck versus Bell. And then also, maybe at the end of the show, you sent me an article in a Harvard Law Journal, and I wanted to ask you a bit about the article, but mostly if you know someone who's a previous editor of that journal. So I guess to take these chronologically, let's start with Standing Bear is a Person. This is a book that you helped to promote by your article. I don't think the audience, probably not one in 100 people, are aware of this horrific case of this poor guy, in fact, of his tribe. Can you tell us about Standing Bear is a Person?
Absolutely. And I'm like the audience. I didn't know of it. And when you hear where I'm from, you'll be shocked that I just said that. Mm. But the Ponca Indians resided in the area then now known as Nebraska.
It was part of the Dakota Territory, right?
I think that's right. It was not a state yet. Let's put it that way. Right. And there were, you know, the expansion was going on. There were Indian wars. And okay, that's about all I know. That's probably about anybody in the audience knows.
Yeah.
I came from an area where that was 40 miles north of Ponca City, Oklahoma. That's where I grew up. And I did not know what I'm about to tell you.
Wow. Because Ponca City got its name after a rather horrific part of our history. But go ahead. Yes. Mm-hmm. And we're talking the story, really, it could start around 1804 and then 1877, where it gets really horrific. But go ahead.
Well, it just started off in the book, and we're talking about a book that I have on my shelf over here, but I'd written a book review of it because I thought the story was stunning and had never heard of it. The author had dug up a moment in history, it was a very sad moment in history, where the Ponca Indians were forced marched off of their property. They were agrarian, by the way, so they lived on farms and they were agrarian people. They were peaceful.
Yeah, in fact, Lewis and Clark met the Poncas and they said that they lived in well-settled permanent houses and they found them to be friendly and peaceful. But the Poncas were also the victims of another tribe that was more violent and hostile. But go ahead.
Well, what happened was the Battle of Little Bighorn was between the United States, the Army, you know, Custer's last stand.
Yes.
And another tribe, I believe it was the Sioux Indians.
The Lakota Sioux and the Cheyenne Indians. And Rebecca, that's not too far north of us here. And we've been to that battlefield, as millions have. And it's a devastating part of history for so many reasons. But okay, yeah, there was the Battle of Little Bighorn.
So this is drama in real life that it just was a book on a shelf that I happened to see, Standing Bear as a Person, and it caught my eye. And the story, though, by this author, whose name is Stephen Dando Collins, was how the Poncas were forced marched down to Oklahoma Territory, which was not a state yet either. And they were dumped off there with no rations, no farm equipment. Many, many people died on the way during the march. They lost their oxen and their property was confiscated back in Nebraska. It was a horrific, horrific order out of the military to relocate, resettle these Native Americans down in Oklahoma.
Enforced marches are known to be devastating. And in fact, not only their livestock, as you mentioned, 2 years after resettlement, 600 of their 700 horses were dead or stolen, and 25 yoke of oxen were all dead. And about 160 of the 766 who began the march died. So it was a devastating time.
It was devastating. Your heart just weeps at the thought of this, but it was this excuse of, well, we have a war, right? They claimed this war commanded this result, and that's the government's, there's always an emergency, right? Mm-hmm. We had an emergency. There was this battle of Little Bighorn. Now we got a war, so we're going to have to relocate this tribe down to Oklahoma, even if they die along the way. So that's the excuse given to seize their property and move them. And then, so it was so dire in Oklahoma, as the story's told, that a few of the chiefs made their way back up through Kansas and into Nebraska territory, back to safe haven with an Omaha tribe. That was the name of the tribe, not a city yet. And they were found out about by the military in Washington. And so the military starts getting upset that, five or six chiefs made it back up to Nebraska. And they ordered a local, one of the local military guys at the outpost there, who turned out to be the hero, to capture them or arrest them. But they forgot to say to relocate them. And that military guy in Nebraska, which wasn't Nebraska yet, he let a local newspaper man know what had happened and what was going on. Mm-hmm. And the newspaper man was just up in arms, and he got a couple of lawyers who were railroad lawyers. So basically they didn't have anything to do with, the Bill of Rights or anything like that. They went to court to try to free Standing Bear from this capture by a friendly military general. And they let all these churches know about what had just happened. And the lawyers were trying to get Standing Bear freed under the habeas corpus statute.
Okay, habeas corpus, a little Latin lingo there. For the sake of the audience, could you tell us what that means? Corpus, like Corpus Christi, body of Christ, corpus is body. So what's habeas corpus?
Well, loosely translated, without looking it up myself, I would say it means free the body or give us the body.
Present the body.
So, yeah, it's frequently used today. It's a longstanding statute, but he had to be a person. And the federal government attorneys were arguing he was not a person. And so, therefore, the action for habeas corpus had to fail because he didn't qualify for it.
So they argued that this American Indian, that he was not a person, and therefore to present the person wouldn't apply because he's not a person. It's like trying to do habeas corpus on a buffalo. It doesn't count. It's not a person. That's what they were arguing.
And, when you're a lawyer and you're trying to explain how crazy it gets there in the courtroom, well, this is an example. It was a horrific time in history. There was a courageous judge out there in the wilds of Nebraska Territory, which wasn't Nebraska yet. He wrote an opinion and he said, by under the natural law, you are a person and you're entitled to be set free. And he was set free.
Well, and thank God for justice, finally. But even in the Dred Scott decision, which is a crime against humanity itself, where they ruled that basically most black people, black slaves, are property. They're chattel, the term that they used. That didn't even argue that they're not persons, actually. It didn't argue they're not persons. But
right,
here,
it was a citizen question.
Yeah.
Where they tended to be covered by citizenship. And yes, that decision, the Dred Scott case, turned on the question, well, who's a citizen?
Mm-hmm.
But this literally turned on who is a person.
Wow. Oh, and by the way, I just looked up, when was the 14th Amendment ratified? And that was July of 1868. So that had just been ratified.
Okay, well, there you go. Thank you for checking me.
Oh, no, sure.
I did get the book out, but as you reminded me, it's been 10 years since I wrote that
yes,
book preview.
Yes.
And the reason I wrote it is the drama of how it came about. It looked like, when you're reading this horrific story, it looked like, how do you beat the government? How do you beat this power that's done this to an entire group of people? Well, one person at a time. And there was a friend of Standing Bear's daughter. The daughter had died, but her friend was an Omaha Indian. And so she approached her chief about how to help Standing Bear, because obviously, you know, she knew him from having been friends with his daughter. And so that's how it kind of came about, just one person at a time. And then this newspaper editor decided he was going to grab the bull by the horns. So he starts publicizing the plight of the Ponca Indians, and he starts getting all the churches, you know, riled up, and mm-hmm. starts making public sentiment turn in favor of the Poncas. And then he got these attorneys who volunteered their time. I'm sure they weren't paid, but mm-hmm. they went to court. I'm sure they weren't equipped either. You know, mm-hmm. this is not their area of law. But they argued for the truth, and they argued for justice. And then there was the judge. So these are all pivotal people in history, and
wow.
you see how important each person is in history just by this one snapshot of time.
Yeah, the person who thinks they can't win it all, so they don't do anything, is making such a grievous error. We were on for years, Rebecca, on TV in 80 cities around the country, two full-power TV stations in Oklahoma. One was Tulsa, the other Oklahoma City, and on cable and satellite TV throughout the state. And I would hear from viewers, listeners in Ponca City, and it never dawned on me that the history behind the name of that city was so devastating. So thank you for educating us about Standing Bear, and Standing Bear is a person. And when we go from that time, a quarter of a century later, we get to a case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And then about a quarter of a century later, we get to Buck v. Bell. So maybe describe Buck v. Bell, and then we'll back up into Jacobson versus Massachusetts.
All right, well, let's just talk about this arc of history from the time of the Civil War to today. Most of us don't know this part of history, which really was white supremacy, but it was scientized as a specific part of biology called eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
It developed out of Charles Darwin's
oh, yeah.
Origin of the Species in 1859. That's when he published his work, The Origin of the Species.
Well, Francis, you know, Galton was really the major proponent, and he is a relative of Charles Darwin. I think he was a cousin, perhaps.
Right. In that time that we're talking about with Indian Wars, right after the Civil War, there was a lot of academic study of this idea that some people advance if the resources are too scarce. That's a Malthusian idea that, well, when the resources are too scarce, the fit survive and you kill off the weak.
Hmm.
And then that got incorporated into biology by Francis Galton, as you just said. He called it eugenics because it was the idea that you could do that on purpose. You could weed out the unfit on purpose, right?
Right.
And that even became part of academia and a lot of research and writing. And Francis Galton established his chair in eugenics at the London School of Economics in 1904.
Mm.
Charles Darwin and his cousin Francis Galton work together to develop this idea that you can breed a better race of people, a thoroughbred of humans, if you just eliminate the unfit and promote reproduction of the fit. Mm. So that was the general idea. And you had all these academics just wholesale embracing this idea of eugenics. To this day, they still do. They don't call it eugenics anymore.
Let me share this a quote from Darwin, because leftist evolutionists who might be listening to this, they recoil immediately and they think this is all made up, you know. But of course, it is utterly documented with primary sources, including Darwin's own writing, like his book, The Descent of Man, on page 156 of the copy that I checked out of a library, has this quote. You could find it on Google Books. And he writes that man in a more civilized state, such as the Caucasian, and he says there's a great distance between whites or Caucasians and apes or baboons. And he says, but at present, the distance between the Negro and the Aboriginal, they're very close to the gorilla and the baboon, or they're much closer. So it was this devastating view that human beings are animals, and if they're animals, then you could treat them like animals. And out of this was born eugenics.
Right. Yeah, it sprang right from that view, and it continued on. It got into academia, and the 1904 date is plugged into my mind. That's what I think of as the start in academia, because that's when Francis Galton launched his chair at the London School of Economics. So let's fast forward back to today. I want to flip around between the past and present. But I was listening to an oral argument out of one of the first cases where the churches did prevail. But the local government was trying to shut down a drive-in church service, of all things, over these emergency orders.
Wow.
And the argument was that a 1905 vaccine case by the United States Supreme Court called Jacobson versus Massachusetts was the authority for shutting down drive-in church services in 2020.
Wow. Keep open walk-in pot shops, but close down drive-in church. Wow.
Yeah. And so I heard that argument and I heard that case and I just was shocked. And I pulled that case up and I read it, and it didn't stand for anything similar to shutting down drive-in churches in the year 2020.
Right.
It had to do with a state statute requiring vaccinations of adults, not children. And if you didn't get vaccinated, you had to pay a $5 fine. It was upheld with very loosey-goosey language, however, by the United States Supreme Court, mm-hmm. in part because the case had been brought so poorly. So that language was extrapolated by the advocates of these emergency orders and utilized to shut down the economy in the United States of America in 2020. And I've just been beside myself ever since. Mm. Because that case from the time period it came from was then used in the 1920s, 1927 to be precise. The eugenics movement had grown and proliferated and just expanded and lobbied for sterilization, forcible sterilization laws all over the country. And they got adopted all over the country, California, Indiana, Kansas, you name it. And one of those statutes made it to the Supreme Court out of Virginia, and it was upheld by the United States Supreme Court. The very infamous quote was, well, three generations of imbeciles are enough, citing Jacobson versus Massachusetts.
That's Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Correct. And again, Jacobson did not stand for forcible sterilization either, but that's how it was utilized. And that was then the basis for sterilizing some 63,000 or more forcibly involuntary sterilizations in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years, There were apologies by a few of the states
for forcibly sterilizing, for example, people of mixed race or people who society looked down upon. The powers that be decided they're not going to have kids.
They decided you were feeble-minded. They decided you were an imbecile. They decided you had a disease or you were unfit. Right. It was the powerful imposing on the weak.
Rebecca, there's a film. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's got a lot of big name Hollywood stars in it, but it was written and produced by a dear friend of this program, Fred Foote. And it's called Alleged, and it's on the Scopes Monkey Trial out of Tennessee. But it deals with a subplot is the forced sterilization of this young girl because her parents were black and white. And this film, it stars really well-known actors, Brian Dennehy, Fred Thompson, Colm Meaney, and Ashley Johnson from The Help and The Avengers. What a great film. And you see up close and personal the horror of what happened over 60,000 times in America because of the eugenics movement. We have on our YouTube channel, Bob and Yurt Live, Ma'afa 21, about the forced sterilization of blacks, which was a part of that. And one other minor detail, the left goes nuts when you point out that the Germans, the National Socialists, were motivated by Darwinian socialism and Darwinian eugenics, and they claim that's foul. It's not true. But it's only not true if you ignore the writings of the Nazis who were implementing all these programs because they openly discussed their commitment to Darwinism.
Yes, and Nazism was described as applied biology. That was the definition given, although
it
wasn't the translation of the name.
Yeah,
I want to go back to Hunter's Civic Biology.
That was the
name
textbook.
Of the book.
Yeah.
That was the book in the Scopes trial. And that book introduced school children to eugenics.
So Rebecca,
the civic biology of the day was the centerpiece. Hunter's civic biology centered on eugenics. That was the nature of the dispute at that time.
Rebecca, I think in my life, you're the first person who just came out and knew the name of the textbook that led to the trial of the century. I mean, this truly was the trial of the century, even if you include OJ. This was bigger than the OJ trial. And Hunter's Civic Biology, which was what the Christians, as represented by William Jennings Bryan, were opposing. And Hunter's Civic Biology, if you think about that, the whole purpose for the title was eugenics. And that book presented blacks as closer to apes, just like Charles Darwin had done. And that's what the ACLU, that's what the Baltimore Sun, that's what Clarence Darrow was defending, and it was evil.
Well, and so today we hear this mantra, follow the science, and science has a lot to live down, to be humbled about, to apologize for, to retract. Because now, today, we have science aligned with government and all their vast, legal support, trying to shut down the nations of the world and everyone's freedom on an idea that also coincidentally happens to be fueled by trillions of dollars in funding to the same special interests that are trying to push the solution to the problem. So they've overstated the problem. They've certainly overstated the reaction politically by depriving people of our freedoms. And they've taken trillions and trillions of dollars to pay themselves for vaccines that are of questionable value. I saw a headline saying that, one of these vaccines supposedly prevents 98% of the deaths from COVID. Okay, well, 98 or 99% of the people who get COVID don't die. Yet again, it's questionable science. and possibly destructive science, certainly destructive of people's rights and freedoms. So that was not the end of eugenics. Buck versus Bell was kind of the beginning. During the war, an executive order, it was a military / civilian order to relocate all of the Japanese Americans out of California. Mm-hmm. They were like Standing Bear. They were just forcibly removed from their homes. They were placed into camps for 4 years. No due process, couldn't access their homes, couldn't travel. And they were just treated like prisoners.
No habeas corpus.
No habeas corpus.
Although I don't really like using Latin in English courtrooms. But go ahead, I interrupt.
Well, there's a whole history there, too, about the Roman history to our American law. It goes all the way back, to the Roman days. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Korematsu was another case of horrible use of emergency powers against a whole group of people. That went on for 4 years. As far as I know, they were kept in seclusion, so to speak. But after the war, so eugenics got a bad name, right? During the war, people understood that it was connected to the Holocaust. So the name was dropped. And again, the leaders of eugenics recognized they had to change the name. So they called it population studies. And any other name, birth control, and they moved away from harping on races per se. They just referred to, we want to provide these services to the poor. Well, of course, the poor, we're minorities.
Right. Yeah, and Margaret Sanger, of course, with her Birth Control League, then Planned Parenthood, was very involved in the eugenics movement and was had a cozy relationship with German eugenicist and American eugenicist. So it's an incredibly ugly and well-documented part of history that the left has completely ignored or denied even.
Well, and that was the science of white supremacy that has been propped up by the left and adhered to like a religion by the left. They don't want to recognize their own white supremacy that was scientized, popularized, and forced on everybody else. And this is the contrast that our wonderful Declaration of Independence, our wonderful Constitution, stood up against that idea, because our Declaration said all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. That was in stark contrast to that view. Now, so that was before Darwin's time, but we're still talking about the two ways, biblically speaking, a way of life and a way of death. And the way of death is that which Darwin, Galton, and the eugenics movement promoted and still do. Because when it got past World War II and they became just focused on reproduction, we're going to kill the unborn. And they would target the black neighborhoods. They would target the countries that they wanted to reduce the population in. And to this day, we see those two ways, the ways of life and the ways of death. Mm. And our Declaration of Independence does stand for the way of life and
Rebecca,
the dignity of people.
Let me interrupt Rebecca with an announcement for those just joining us from the radio broadcast portion of today's show. Those who've come to the website, kgovkgov.com, we're continuing our interview with Rebecca Messel, the attorney for Denver Bible Church. But I want to thank those who have given so far to the telethon. We're at $21,500, and the goal is $50,000. And we have, the end of the month is approaching quickly. So if you can possibly help, we will be so thankful, and it's so desperately needed to keep us reaching more people throughout the year. Either call us 1-800-8-NYARDS. That's 1-800-836-9278, or go to the website kgovkgov.com and click on the store or the telethon banner. And please, if you can, a one-time donation, an automatic monthly donation, or a subscription to any of our services, Bible study, sermons, videos, they all go toward the telethon goal. Or if you browse our science department, our other resources, everything purchased or donated during this month will go directly toward the goal of $50,000. And now, continuing with Rebecca. Rebecca, on Wikipedia, I've made about 1,000 edits over the last 15 years, and I think over 90% of them stand. But the ones I've tried to make over and over on Margaret Sanger's primary article, the left refuses to allow these quotes to stand. I'd like to share them with you real quickly. She wrote two books. She's the founder of Planned Parenthood. She was honored with the Margaret Sanger Award until a year ago. Probably will continue to be so. But one is called Woman and the New Race, and the other is Pivot of Civilization. And she is so despising of innocent life, of minorities, and of the handicapped. On page 112 of her book, Pivot of Civilization, she wrote that the handicapped, including, quote, the blind, deaf, dumb, mute, and epileptic, were the dead weight of human waste. That's her words, and she has been idolized by the left for the last century, and that wasn't a one-off. That's who she was. And then she wrote in Woman in the New Race on page 33, she wrote this, not about abortion, but about after a baby is born to a large family. She wrote, the most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it.
Well, in Roe versus Wade, I did write a paper on the history of eugenics in Roe. And one of the authorities cited in the opinion is Glanville Williams. Glanville Williams was an attorney, but his book that was cited nearly verbatim quotes what you just said from what he's not quoting from Margaret Sanger, but
he's just saying it himself.
Nearly parroting the same concept.
Yeah, and when you look at people who are idolized by the left to this day, they are advocating not abortion in the womb only, but they're advocating what they call afterbirth abortion. And this is published in the Journal of Medical Ethics, that it should be legal to kill the baby for any reason in the first months after it's born. In the New York Times, why they kill their newborns, a horrific call to decriminalize infanticide by MIT's Steven Pinker. And it goes on and on. We have, Rebecca, at American Right to Life's website, an article I've written on infanticide and those advocating for infanticide, the Journal of Philosophy and Public Affairs, Discover Magazine, The Guardian, Richard Dawkins. In fact, in England, horrifically, the Anglican Church of England, they back killing handicapped babies. But many of these say it should be legal for any reason. But many of them also say if you have a handicapped baby, it should be legal to kill the baby. And the Drudge Report had a shock report headline, college students increasingly support post-birth abortion. And our list goes on and on and on, including all the way to Denver's Children's Hospital with their four-year-old Dylan Walborn, who they encouraged the parents to starve Dylan to death, which they did, even though he wasn't dying, he was handicapped. So, and in the New England Journal of Medicine in Belgium, there is a crisis going on where we're moving from abortion to open advocacy of infanticide.
Well, and what history tells us is when you resort to killing and making that legal, it's not within any boundaries. You cannot contain it. And so then you see the sweep of history in our modern age. It's been done. We saw it happen. People don't want to remember it. They are the Holocaust deniers. They don't want to see how it came about. They don't want to see that it came about. And they don't want to see it today. So they just, again, hide this whole thing as if it were science in their academic journals and speak about it and then fund it through the government and pretend like it's not what it is. It's a huge denial. But going back to today, now we know, and I suppose people will deny that these shutdowns occurred, but they are occurring. They have occurred. Churches were closed, are closed. Gyms were closed, are closed. Businesses bankrupted. What we're witnessing today, the shutdown of the economy, that's a polite way to say we're going to deprive people of their freedom across the board, across the globe. And it's been done under the guise of a false science.
Right.
There was no basis for what's been done to people. And our rights still prevail. We just have to all take our place and assert them and require that they be honored.
So, Rebecca, we only have a few minutes left. We've gone from Standing Bear is a person to the 1905 Jacobson versus Massachusetts with a mandatory vaccination law for adults, $5 fine if you refuse, to the 1927 case of Buck v. Bell, which upheld forced sterilization of, you say, 63,000. I think that's a number that's well established by scholars, 63,000 Americans. And I mentioned that you recommended an article in the current issue of a Harvard Law Journal. So I thought maybe we could just briefly mention that. But it also really gives me an opportunity to brag that a former editor of the Harvard Law and Public Policy Journal, Josh Craddock, he actually helped us produce one of our Bible resources called The Plot Boys when I think he was 12 years old, 35 sessions in studio. And he was published in that journal with a tremendous article against abortion and upholding the personhood of the unborn child. And that paper has been published widely, including in arguments to the Supreme Court. So we're really honored to count Josh Craddock as one of our fellow warriors for the Lord and for the innocent.
I read his article. I myself cited his article to the United States Supreme Court.
I didn't realize had. Wow.
Oh, yes. It was a personhood case for some frozen embryos that still live in, suspended animation there in Colorado. And I didn't get a hearing, but I did rely on Josh Craddock. Praise God.
Yeah, that is wonderful. Rebecca, since you mentioned that, some people call them snowflake children. And we had one mom in studio years ago, and her daughter was FedExed to her, literally FedExed across the country, and doctors implanted her daughter in her womb, and 9 months later, she was born. And so to deny the humanity of this snowflake child is utter anti-science, utter ignorance, but isn't it astounding that they actually FedEx the baby across the country? And that is proof beyond any proof that at the moment of conception, at the moment of fertilization, you have a tiny little boy or a little girl, and it's a separate body. It's not its mother's body. It's not its father's body. It's its own little boy or girl's body.
That is so true. I can't thank you enough for all your work, Bob, through the years. The article by Justice Scalia's son, who is an attorney, and his name's Eugene Scalia.
Mm-hmm.
The article is in the winter 2021 issue of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. And he was lamenting or pointing out a problem, which those of us doing these kinds of cases already know exists. Big law firms, we're talking ginormous law firms, represent multinational companies and power, politics, political parties, and they're not going to get involved when it comes likely to human embryos, the unborn, to these issues of freedom, like we're talking about, because they're so divisive. They take up for the government because that's who pays the bills.
Mm.
And Eugene Scalia was lamenting that there's a brain drain, obviously, in favor of the the big and powerful when what we need are lawyers to step up. John Adams was an attorney, one of the founding fathers of our country. But in the time of the war with Great Britain, after the Boston Massacre, he took up the defense for one or more of the soldiers from, I believe they were British soldiers. So it would have been a very unpopular case, but he did it because he believed in justice, in the right to representation. And that was the point of Eugene Scalia's article, was that lawyers need to step up. If we're going to have a constitution, lawyers have to defend it. And that means even if you're in a big law firm, even if you're doing mergers and acquisitions.
Well, his argument, Rebecca, reminds me a little bit of what Sean Hannity said a couple years ago about the FISA courts. And I remember on this show quoting Sean Hannity and saying, no, it's not true. Hannity was saying that we have some bad apples in the intelligence community, the FBI, CIA, and they filed fraudulent affidavits with the FISA courts, but the FISA court judges are honorable, true, and noble, and they will be outraged and they'll bring a stop to this. And I remember thinking, no, the FISA court judges, they couldn't care less. They wouldn't even slap the hand of the people who are doing wrong. And fast forward a couple years later, that's exactly the case. It's like they only want to sweep everything under the rug. No doubt they were part of the pro-Hillary Russia hoax mindset. But when Eugene Scalia argues this, it's as though it's just that the attorneys aren't doing what they should be doing. I would argue that attorneys are like the culture at large, and probably a majority of them actually are against God-given freedoms and God-given rights, and they support what is actually destructive to our society. That's from my perspective. Do you think that's naive? Do you think?
No, I imagine lawyers are representative of the culture at large. We've all been feeding at the same trough of popular knowledge, which is woven with this false science.
Right.
And science itself is corrupted by the money, because they're chasing government contracts and they're chasing bids for this and that. They're trying to make their science look as good as it can get in order to get the money. And so, you know, all of these professions that we call professions, whether you're a doctor or a scientist, researcher, or lawyer, you know, we are really called to maintain ethics. Mm-hmm. And I think the ethics have really fallen apart in the recent decade.
Just like doctors have given up, medical schools have given up on the Hippocratic Oath and so on. So we are out of time. There's the closing music. Rebecca Messel,
thank you, Bob.
It's such a joy to have you on the show. And thank you to you and Brad Burkford for representing Denver Bible Church. We love you guys.
Thank you, Rob. It's a privilege. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. And our website, and our telethon, kgov.com. Please help if you possibly can.